Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Learning how to write has been a rite of passage for generations of American children. Remember the hours spent practicing cursive handwriting, tracing loops and curlicues, and shaking out stiff fingers and sore wrists? Well, enter the digital age. In recent years, lessons in cursive have been disappearing from curricula across the country. This after the Common Core standards whittled the requirement for handwriting to lessons taught in kindergarten and first grade. It's a trend that has brought jeers and cheers. Really, how many of us actually spend time handwriting letters these days? But proponents of handwriting say learning it can benefit fine motor skills and the developing brains of children. So, should states in the Delaware Valley follow the lead of Louisiana and California and Florida and other states in mandating cursive handwriting lessons for public school children? Let us know what you think. The number is 888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And joining us now to begin our discussion is Ann Trubeck, who is author of The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting. Ann, welcome to Radio Times.
Great to be here.
So we're going to get to the history in just a moment, but to start us off, tell us, which side of the debate do you land on?
I am definitely on the side that says it's just fine if kids aren't graded on their ability to master cursive in elementary school.
So we're talking about grading, but eventually, if it disappears from school classrooms, is that something that would bother you?
No, I think that would be fine. There are many fine motor skills that we used to teach that have disappeared, like home economics, wood shop, sewing. And we've all survived. And cursive is not something that is pragmatically useful to kids who are or even to adults right now. And so it would be fine if it dropped out of the curriculum.
All right. We'll get to what proponents say in just a little bit on Radio Time. So first, let's take a deep dive into some history, go about 3,000 years back into that of some written communication, Sumerian cuneiform. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so the first writing that humans did was cuneiform, which is a writing system of marks and triangles and slashes that were impressed on clay. So people would write by taking a stick, basically, and a wet piece of clay and putting marks into the clay and then putting the clay out to dry. And that was their writing system. And these tablets, it's funny because they're not so different than the tablets many of us write on today with smartphones. Were portable and palm-sized. And what's remarkable about cuneiform is that we have a lot of it left because clay is just a very durable writing surface. It's much more durable than paper, or even we may find digital forms of communication. But you cannot identify a single writer from all the cuneiform we have left. They all look identical, as if machines made the marks and not individuals. So it's so fascinating.
Hey, what was the role of the Sumerian scribe?
So there's a lot we don't know, right? I mean, this is a long time ago, and
sure,
there's a lot of information has been lost. But scribes were basically well-born boys. There may have been some girls who were taught to write, who went to school, and the schools, the first schools ever that humans developed, were called tablet houses, and they were exclusively for teaching children how to write. That's all they learned in school. And it took years to master cuneiform because it's a very, very complicated system, much more complicated than our alphabet.
Throughout much of early history, writing was reserved for the wealthy, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So in ancient Egypt, writing was even more restricted than it was in Sumeria. Some experts estimate that it was not just the 1% that learned how to write, but the 0.3%. So the vast majority of Egyptians were illiterate, and they would walk through those buildings with those beautiful hieroglyphs and not know what they meant. With Greece and Rome, literacy rates went up, and those were civilizations that really valued education, and so there were a greater percentage of people. But then in the medieval era, it contracted again, and the church held closely on the reins of who was allowed to learn how to read and write. So it definitely, it's not a clear path of more and more literacy. It goes up and down, but certainly there are far more literate humans today than ever in the past.
Let's go back to Egypt for just a moment. I'd like you to read, if you could, a passage from your book. And this is on page 16, and it regards the boys who were of the elite who were learning how to write.
Sure. With the blank roll of papyrus on his left, a student would pull a scroll until one section sat comfortably across his lap. This constituted a page of hieroglyphs. On his lap rested a scribal kit, an exalted, sometimes religious object. One was placed in King Tut's tomb that contained two inkwells, one red, one black, and a vessel for water used to wet the ink. The black ink was made from carbon, the red ink from an iron oxide. The boy used the red ink, as would the Christians centuries later, think Red Letter Day, only for important words and headings. His ink choice also had religious resonances. He would switch from black to red, a color associated with danger, to write the word evil, for example. To write, or perhaps more precisely to paint, the boy took up a long, thin, hollowed-out tool made out of the reeds that grew in the fields around him. He chewed on one end of the reed to make it into a brush. Dipping his brush into the ink, he copied homilies, such as, "Be a scribe, so that your limbs may become sleek, that your hands may become soft, that you may go forth admired in white attire, and that your courtiers may salute you."
It's something we don't think about, but it took so much more to write centuries and millennia ago.
Yes, and hieroglyphs were even more elaborate than cuneiform. So there are so many hieroglyphic characters. Some neurologists have speculated that the brains of Egyptians who learned how to write hieroglyphs are probably the most advanced in terms of those areas of the brain ever in human history.
So in some, I don't know if there's a connection here, but some would say that there is a real connection between children who need to sit down and learn how to write first block letters and then cursive, between that activity and positive developments in the brain.
I don't think there's anything conclusive there, and we certainly have plenty of examples of people throughout history who never learned to write and who had very developed brains and very intelligent. There's no necessary correlation between being able to handwrite and intelligence. There may be some activities in the brain that are ignited by learning these things, but they also could be ignited by other forms of fine motor skills. And again, as I just said, our alphabet is actually a very simple system. And if one wanted to, you know, ignite as many neurons as possible in the child's brain, perhaps we should teach them Chinese or hieroglyphs.
And in fact, you do point out in your book, Anne Trubeck, that Socrates was not a fan of the written word.
That's right. The idea that, you know, writing is the be-all, end-all is not always been true. Socrates was very much against writing in Greek culture. He argued that writing would cause us to forget, that our memories would shrink, that the most complex ideas come through conversation face to face, and that with a written piece of writing, as he says, it's dead. It doesn't answer your questions. You can't have that back and forth conversation. And it is certainly true that members of oral cultures have much more capacious memories than members of literate cultures. I mean, just imagine if you could never look anything up. Imagine how much harder you would work to memorize things and keep it in your brain.
Yeah. We've got calls and comments coming into our Radio Times, 888-477-9499. And we've got an email from Julio who asks, please have your guest address the origins of writing in pre-Sumerian times in the East, China and Japan. And Anne, I don't know if you have that information at your fingertips, but care to take a crack at it?
I am not an expert. My focus is really on the West, but there were many fascinating forms of what linguists will call proto-writing. So, for instance, the Mayans used different forms of knots, and there was Africans had drumming sort of forms of communication that were like writing. Pretty much everyone agrees that Sumer was the first writing in the way that we understand it now.
Cursive has always been a faster way to write. The words, of course, are connected. And its history, if I'm reading your book correctly, goes back to the time of the Egyptians, at least?
In terms of developing a script that would go faster, yes. The Egyptians had three forms of script. They had hieroglyphs, which are the best known. But then they had two others, hieratic and demotic. And the purpose of those was to allow people to write faster. So if you were somebody whose job it was to write administrative documents or bureaucratic documents, you would use this faster script. And that is really the root of cursive, is that it allows you to go faster. And much of writing's history is about technologies developed to allow us to write faster so that it keeps pace with our thoughts.
So back to hieroglyphics for a moment. That they were a form of written communication that was around thousands of years, but eventually that form of communication died out. Do you draw a parallel here to cursive handwriting?
The history of writing is a history of writing systems and writing technologies dying out. Absolutely. There have been really three great revolutions in writing history: the invention of writing, the invention of the printing press, which had a huge influence on culture and society, and then the invention of the computer. And with each revolution, you see really large changes that rock the cultures going through them. But then once you're on the other side, it all seems as if it should be, and it seems unimaginable that things used to be different. And I think we're at that place right now. People are really invested in cursive, I think partially because we're at the point where it no longer matters. And that's upsetting and confusing and threatening.
Do you think voice activation will eventually replace the keyboard entry back?
You know, I don't know. I'm not a futurist, but I will say that if you think of writing as the ability to, express thoughts, speaking is the most natural form, right? Writing is artificial. All forms of writing require a technology, not just computers. I mean, the Egyptians required reed, and they required papyrus. You need all this equipment in order to write. To speak, you don't need it. You also don't need to be taught it in school. So voice recognition software is in some ways the purest and most authentic way to get the thoughts in your head communicated to your audience. And I do think it's a wonderful thing. Some of our best contemporary novelists use it. And certainly throughout history, some of our most famous figures have used it.
Anne Trubeck has written The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting. She'll be with us for the next little while on Radio Times. And we'll also be joined by Laura Deinhardt, Associate Professor of Early Childhood Education at Florida International University. 888-477-9499 is the number. Keep it here. Radio Times is back after this. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've been talking about handwriting this hour of Radio Times with Anne Trubeck, who's written The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting. And also joining us now, Laura Deinhardt, Associate Professor of Early Childhood Education at Florida International University. Welcome to Radio Times, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And just a quick note, later in the show, we're going to look at left-handedness and the latest research into what it means to be a lefty. So if you'd like to get your questions and comments ready for that. But again, for the next segment, we're looking at the future of cursive handwriting. Is it a dying art? Should it be? 888-477-9499 is the number. And we've got a number of calls coming in. Promise to get to those in just a moment. But Laura, first to you, what do you think of this trend toward eliminating the teaching of cursive handwriting?
You know, I will say that most of my work really focuses on early childhood, but particularly with cursive, I think we just don't have enough research to really know what the effects will ultimately be if we were simply to get rid of it. Certainly, we know that there's research that shows that cursive writing is a faster form of writing, that students are able to produce more on paper if they're writing in a sort of quick, automatic way. But in some countries, they never really even learn print. They move straight to cursive. So if the goal is for students to really be automatic in their writing process, then perhaps what they have to be doing is thinking about cursive sort of earlier, if that's how we want students to write. But there's just not enough research out there for us really to make a true decision on it, so that if we just get rid of it altogether, we don't know what the effects will be long term.
Well, let's talk briefly about a study done by Karen James, a psychologist at Indiana University, who found that there was greater brain activity in young children who hadn't yet learned to read, but when they were asked to produce a letter by drawing it as opposed to tracing it or typing it on the computer, that's when you saw the greater brain activity. So what does this tell us?
Yeah. You know, we have to think of writing as a motor activity. So anytime we're having children spending time producing with their hands, they're also learning. In early childhood in particular, we know that kids are learning by being active. And so we like to think, those of us who kind of study this area, we like to think of writing as being able to produce what the letter form and function in a sort of model in your brain. If you are typing the letter A, or if you are simply pressing the letter B on a tablet, for instance, it doesn't have the same feeling. So writing is in part a motor activity that allows you to really create those letters, and creating that writing, creating sentences, creating paragraphs, really allows you to think about the process of what you're doing. So it slows things down a little bit, yes. But particularly for young kids, it really sets in place sort of a visual, but also a motoric letter, in a sense, that really kind of wraps into their brain. We can think of it that way.
So those who say that there is a connection to the stimulation of brain development, that there might be something there.
Yeah, I think particularly in early childhood. You know, I teach college at this point, and certainly I would not ask my students to be turning in papers, you know, written by hand. You know, I agree in a sense that sometimes, you know, we have lots of students, for instance, who have very poor handwriting and they're brilliant. It's not really necessarily a direct relationship with intelligence. We know that. But what we do know is that in early childhood, the ability to produce something gives them an extra push. It gives, you know, they're learning multimodally. They're not just looking at something, they're not just hearing something, but rather they are producing something with their hands, which I think is valuable.
Anne Trubeck, you want to weigh in here?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, one question I would have is, if the kids are working multimodally but on something other than writing a letter, does it have the same effect?
You know, I think, you know, you mentioned earlier kind of this idea that some of our fine motor skills we're no longer doing. We're also not doing things like art in school, right? We know that that's getting cut. We know that physical education is getting cut. These are activities that have long been a part of the educational system, and in reality, we cut them because they're not seen as valuable anymore to the testing system. So we want kids to produce writing because it's easier for them. It's easier to be read, in a sense, if they're producing writing via keyboard. But we know that at least if kids are producing something with their hands, yes, it can be other things. It could be art. I think we can expand on some of those. Mm-hmm. But I think letter writing is kind of the basis for what we think about when we think about literacy, and being able to produce those then has effects on other sort of areas. Even math, we find that if kids are able to produce certain letters and numbers early on, they also do better in those skills once they're in the system academically.
Laura, you had mentioned earlier that you have some students who are excellent students, but their handwriting mm-hmm. is not so good.
Yeah.
These are the students who might have suffered traditionally academically going through elementary, middle school, high mm-hmm. school, because frankly, if a paper doesn't look good, it's going to be marked with a lower grade.
Yeah. There are also students who have a lot of trouble reading and are brilliant. So there are lots of areas in which, you know, students perhaps struggle, but ultimately it's not an indication of their intelligence. It is, like anything else, one other academic skill. But that also doesn't mean that we should stop doing it just because students are struggling that way. The same thing with reading a book. Not every kid learns to read. Audiobooks are certainly available. Does it mean we should make children suffer through the reading process? No. But it does mean that those you know, that there are ways of teaching those skills that are appropriate. And certainly if it helps them long term, then we should, you know, continue to do so.
All right. We've got a lot of calls, so let's get to some of them and comments as well. But first, Alex in Center City, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to say that, you know, I work with children a lot, young children, 5 to 15. And I think it's so important that kids have, you know, in school and in their early educational period, have some kind of disciplined work that they're being exposed to. Something that, you know, they have to sit down and do, even if it's not fun, it gets boring, but they have to sit down and finish the task because that's what's going to translate into bigger things and into their careers, those kinds of skills. And also, I'd just like to quickly touch on something else that was mentioned. In foreign countries, in Russia specifically, I know, I lived in Russia for several years, if you can't write cursive, you're basically considered illiterate. I mean, nobody even prints by hand. That's not even even considered a literate way of writing.
So cursive, there are two points there. Alex, thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. So there is perspective, and but let's get to the first point, and that is the point of discipline. There is a lot of discipline, as we mentioned in the open. You know, most of us of a certain age remember sitting down and having to go over and over and over the letters until we got them to an approximation of good. But Anne Trubeck, if you take that out of the classroom, are the kids missing something important?
Well, the comment made me think about, you know, in 19th century America, children had a lot, they had to really work hard and be very disciplined to learn how to write. They would do 6 to 8 hours of drills to get their bodies ready to make a letter. Learning to write was so difficult and rigid and routinized in the 19th century. People spent hours and hours and hours on it. And people believed that the harder that you worked to master writing, you would become a better Christian, more moral, that if you were an immigrant, you would become Americanized and more assimilated. And it later in the 19th, early 20th century, it was believed that you would become a better worker and more industrious. So I think we have a lot of cultural connotations with this idea of mastering how to write that change over time. They're not always the same. To us, it seems strange that we would become a better Christian if you mastered a script. Yeah. But for many decades, that was true in America.
Laura Deinhardt?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think we should torture children into writing. You know, I think that writing serves its purpose. I think there are ways to teach it that are developmentally appropriate. And certainly not something, you know, I feel the same way about any subject. You know, learning should be fun and children should enjoy school. And certainly there are things that we all have to do as adults that we don't like to do. And we have to do it. I don't like grocery shopping, but I do it. And you know, we have to participate in those activities. So it's not to say that children shouldn't experience some frustration. I think that's a normal part of writing, too, and overcoming that frustration is important. But they also should enjoy going to school, so we shouldn't make it a sort of skill and drill activity.
So, and just a quick look at perspective. Louisiana State Legislator Beth Mizell was told by a surveyor he couldn't find young people to read the notes on old documents. And Mizell said, I think it's really discouraging to get a note from a college graduate that is printed like a second grader. I mean, Laura, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that has a very personal feel. I mean, certainly nowadays in the age of technology, we're at the point where, you know, we write a handwritten note to somebody, and that really means something. I don't think that used to be the case. And so, you know, I think that form is one thing, function is another. I think it's always nice to see good handwriting and always nice to see, you know, good work, but it doesn't mean that sometimes we don't get handwriting that we find, you know, just terrible. We have to be able to teach it if we expect anybody to actually produce, you know, nice handwriting. But it's more of a personal thing than it is a, you know, specific to speaking to that person.
All right. Well, we've struck a nerve here on Radio Times. Let's get some of these comments. Email from Ron. Handwriting is like a basic form of calligraphy. It's a craft. There are studies that say it activates both sides of the brain, develops motor skills and long-term memory. This is why music and the arts are important. As these areas decline in public schools, what would you recommend to replace it? And a comment from Nigel, cursive is not useless. What kind of underdeveloped adult child prints anything? There's another a look at perspective. And so back to the email from Ron. Again, as these areas decline in public schools, what do you recommend to replace it? We talked about focusing a bit more on the arts, Anne Trubeck.
Yes, I absolutely agree. I mean, and I agree that there should be more emphasis in school on music, on arts, on physical education, on all things that are, you know, away from these traditional, or not traditional, these now, you know, constantly tested subjects. I am absolutely 100% in favor of that. I think cursive is something that kids are graded on in that standardized test way, that should be not happen. But I certainly think all of these, what we, you know, some people would say non-essential things to education should be essential and should be better funded. Absolutely. And it is, I think it would be great to teach cursive or calligraphy in art classes. It is very tied to drawing. People of good handwriting tend to have, you know, are good at drawing and arts, and they should be able to pursue that as much as they want.
Continuing with our telephone calls on Radio Times, Louise is waiting in Wilmington, Delaware. Welcome to Radio Times, Louise.
Hi, good morning. I'm particularly interested in this morning's topic. I have two sons, one of whom is currently a college student at a very elite university in the area, and he simply cannot write at all. He can barely manage his signature, and he does have difficulty deciphering cursive lettering. Which is kind of shocking to me. My other son is severely autistic and attended the Talk Institute and School in Newtown Square, where they teach children as young as 4 years of age cursive exclusively. There is no printing taught at any time for a variety of reasons, many of which have been mentioned by other callers. But one thing that has not been mentioned is that cursive provides an advantage in learning to read, in that many people have difficulty understanding where words stop and start. When you teach cursive, you don't have to worry about the spacing between letters and words.
All right.
Because all of the letters are connected.
Louise, so, since we're up against the clock, I'm just going to jump in, and I'd like to have Laura Deinhardt weigh in on that. Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times, Louise.
You know, I remember having dinner one night with a colleague of mine from France who said, you know, in France, we print is for reading and cursive is for writing. And yet, you know, we learn to print first and then switch to cursive. You know, I have heard of many students who learn very early on to do cursive. This idea that somehow young children can't do cursive, I think, is not necessarily the case. But again, there's just not enough research to really suggest that there is some advantage to cursive. But certainly, you know, I think that it is needed. And that's where I generally fall, is that, you know, if we're going to get rid of something, then let's ensure that there really is no difference between those skills.
All right. I'd like to get one more call in before the break. Anastasia in Newark, Delaware. You're live on Radio Times. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a historian at the University of Delaware, and we sometimes joke that the death of cursive just means more job security for us because we'll be the only ones able to read it soon. So on a serious note, what do you think of cursive as a specialized job skill, the way that reading shorthand is now a positive asset? When you work in certain disciplines.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anne Trubeck?
Yeah, this is great. I mean, absolutely, paleography is, you know, it's already a field within history to learn how to decipher old scripts. 95% of handwritten manuscripts just in English are illegible to us today because they were written in scripts that are so unfamiliar. Shakespeare wrote in something called secretary hand, which takes years now to figure out what those words are. It's so unfamiliar to us now. And so, absolutely, being able to read cursive is difficult today, still, for those of us who know cursive, and may become more difficult in the future. And historians should seize this opportunity for job growth, for sure.
One of our callers had mentioned the signature. If there is no handwriting, there is no unique signature. I mean, you can do it digitally, of course, but it doesn't seem as personal somehow. What do you think? Anne?
Well, it hasn't always been true that a signature marked you as a unique person. You know, I talked about cuneiform back in the past, and there's lots of other examples of that. Courts of law don't really consider a signature anything that would be evidentiary. It's very hard to prove that someone wrote a signature or not. I think there are plenty of ways that we can express our individuality that aren't a signature. We could all have our own emoji. I mean, people will laugh and think that's horrible, but it's definitely true that throughout history there have been different ways that people have marked their uniqueness through writing other than a signature. And we're probably going to find that in the future there will be other new things that we will develop that will have that same role.
And of course, some signatures are completely illegible anyway. So
it's often seen that you're a more prestigious, smart person if your signature is illegible.
Ah. So. Well, Laura Dinehart, quickly, we've got about 30 seconds. Where do you see this going with cursive handwriting? Do you see it hanging around a while?
I'm not sure it will. I mean, I think it might hang out for a little while longer, but certainly with the use of technology and everything, I think we might see, I'm hoping that we hang on to writing at least in the early ages, and then as kids get older, I expect that the keyboard will probably become a more readily available tool for kids.
Well, Laura Dinehart, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Laura is an associate professor of early childhood education at Florida International University. And Anne Trubeck, great to have you with us as well.
It's been great fun. Thank you so much.
Anne has written The History and Uncertain Future of Handwriting. We talk about left-handedness coming right up on Radio Times. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. I'm right-handed, which means I've never had to try to cut a piece of paper with scissors that are awkward to use because scissors for right-handed people are usually available at work or at home or at school. I've never had someone comment on my handedness. While this is probably fairly common for the 12% of the population, which is left-handed. So for the rest of the hour, we ask, what does it mean to be a southpaw? 888-477-9499 is the number. Why are lefties often perceived to be more creative? Also, why do they tend to make less money? Joshua Goodman is associate professor of public policy at Harvard University and is author of a paper called The Wages of Sinistrality, Handedness, Brain Structure, and Human Capital Accumulation. Joshua Goodman, good to have you on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's begin with basic anatomy. The brain structures of people who are left and right-handed are somewhat different. How so?
Something that biologists have noticed is that lefties and righties tend to process language in different parts of their brains. Righties tend to process it in the left hemisphere, and lefties tend to process it actually across both hemispheres. So if you look at the brains of left-handers, the nerve bundle that connects the two hemispheres of the brain is actually a little bit thicker in lefties than it is in righties. And you can see that when righties and lefties get brain injuries, that depending on what part of the brain is injured, a righty and a lefty may retain different parts of their speaking and language abilities as a result of that. So we know that left-handedness is there's something about our brains that really are different.
For your paper, The Wages of Sinistrality, you look at data from decades in the lives of people in the U.S. and the U.K. Just give us a brief overview of that, if you would.
Yeah. So what I do is I use these data sets from the U.S. and from Britain that follow people from very young ages, sometimes from birth, sometimes from when they're teenagers. And early on, they ask people, are you left-handed? Or they even measure whether they're left-handed or not by asking them to do a variety of tasks. And then these data sets follow people until at least their 30s, sometimes longer. So we can see not only what is their handedness, what is their family background, but how did they do in terms of their education? How did they do in terms of tests that they took? How do they do in terms of the jobs that they get later in life? And so we can make these kind of connections in the data.
And you found that lefties tend to make less money than their right-handed counterparts?
That's right. So this was not a good result for me personally, because I'm a righty, but my wife is a lefty. And so this caused a little bit of tension in our household. And you know, she actually, you know, out-earns me. So she disagreed with the study. But it's true that I found that lefties earn maybe 5 or even 10% less than righties do in both the U.S. and in Great Britain.
Well, you know, and there's some tough news again in your study. Your research found that left-handed people are more likely to have learning disabilities. So maybe there's some connection there with the money issue.
That's right. So lefties, across a number of measures, look very slightly disadvantaged. And I want to stress that, you know, that these differences are small, but they are pretty clear. Lefties score a little bit lower on math and reading tests. They're a little bit more likely to have behavioral problems and learning disabilities. They're a little bit more likely to have speech problems, such as a stammer or a stutter. And it may be that this is an indication of some kind of struggle that certain lefties have with language processing that then shows up in their schooling and later career choices. So, again, the differences are small, but they're very clear.
I'm not sure if you have this information, but do we know why there's a slight more of a trend toward learning disabilities among the Southport population?
It's a great question. I think at this point, it's complete speculation. I think the best thing that I can say is that the fact that we have evidence from the medical and biological literature that lefties and righties process language in different ways in the brain may be connected to the fact that they're more likely to have speech problems, dyslexia, those kinds of things. And again, the numbers are low. The vast majority of lefties you meet in life don't have any sort of problems, but there's just a slightly increased likelihood of these things.
As I'm sure your wife would tell you.
Yeah, so I, she does not hesitate to remind me.
Yeah. Well, back to one more question about the tendency to make less money. Might this have anything to do with work equipment that's made primarily for righties?
So that's a great question. And actually, the data that we have allows us to look at what kind of jobs people have. And what I actually found is that lefties are more likely than righties to work in occupations that are manual in nature. So it doesn't seem to be the case that they're disadvantaged because of physical equipment. What seems to be the case is, if anything, that the fact that on average they have slightly lower test scores tends to push them toward occupations where test scores are not as important for getting the jobs, and that may explain why they have lower wages.
So Joshua Goodman, regarding learning, can and should handedness then be used as a screening tool for early intervention with children?
You know, the way that I think about it is, if I were a parent or a teacher and I saw that I had a child who was left-handed, it would make me pay a little extra attention to their development. I would just check in on them periodically and make sure that they were doing okay. But as I said, the rates of these problems are very low, and the differences between lefties and righties, though clear, are also very small. So, I would not be at all concerned if it turned out my children were all left-handed. I would just pay a little extra attention to them.
The last thing you want to do is stigmatize a child.
Exactly.
All right, let's get to the calls. Jim in Wilmington, Delaware, you are on Radio Times with Joshua Goodman. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. I have a situation that I believe is called mixed dominance. I do some things. I write and I hold my fork only with my left hand. I play guitar right hand. I shoot right hand. A lot of other things I do right handed. Also, when I was a kid growing up in the 50s, I was at the cusp of where they used to try to make kids right-handed. So that when we first began to learn to write, the teacher tried to make me use my right hand, but my parents shut that down right away.
What was the reason, Jim, that you were given?
See, back then, apparently, the right-handed, in fact, I've seen this in other cultures, too. You were talking earlier about the place of handwriting in cultures. In Persian and Arabic, for example, the right hand is the hand of honor. You know, that's like the, that there's a, well, there's there are certain functions that people do supposedly with their left hand that are sanitary. And among other things, you know, that's considered, you know, so the right hand is considered the better hand, and you, and beautiful handwriting, in fact, supposedly is, or at least used to reflect on your character in those cultures. But so, you know, so right-handedness was the right way. I mean, it was like, that's how you're supposed to do it. That's what I gathered.
Well, thanks for the call to Radio Times, Jim. So Joshua Goodman, a couple things here. First of all, he said he's mixed. He thinks he's mixed dominance. You don't see that nearly as much, I'm guessing, you know, as you do lefties and, of course, righties.
That's absolutely right. Actually, in some of the data sets that I used in my paper, they actually had the respondents answer a number of questions about various activities, and the vast majority of people will say, I do all of these with my right hand, or I do all of these with my left hand. It's pretty rare to have someone who says, I do, you know, half of the things with my right and the other half with my left. So that's interesting. Mm.
And back to the days when, you know, teachers used to urge children to use their right hand when writing and et cetera. Lefties have just gotten a bad rap, it seems, throughout a lot of history. And for instance, I was reading in The Atlantic that the English word sinister can be traced back to the Latin sinistra, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, meaning left, and that in the Middle Ages, left-handed writers were said to be the devil's voice boxes. Well, why do you think that is?
This is a great question. I mean, my guess is that this is based in nothing more than the kind of superstition that people have about people who are strange and different from them. You know, so left-handedness is, it's rare, right? Only 10-12% of people have it, and we know that humans tend to you know, be pretty unpleasant about picking on small groups. So that's my guess, is that lefties were just sort of seen as a little bit strange, and but, you know, maybe people then sort of had some sense that being left-handed involved something a little bit different about the way your brain worked, but I'm not willing to give them that much credit.
What about the perception that lefties tend to have more of a creative bent?
Yeah, so I'm aware of this. I think that perception is grounded in a series of social science studies that frankly weren't very well done. The people doing them were sort of selective about which results they reported to the public, just to make those results seem more exciting. So in our data, again, we can see what occupations people have, and there's no indication of any difference in lefties and righties' tendency to go into occupations that we might think of as creative. So my best guess is that lefties and righties are probably both creative in equal amounts.
Well, a few decades back, some psychologists at Connecticut College thought perhaps lefties were more creative because they had to constantly improvise to get along in a world dominated by right-handers. And I thought, well, maybe there's something to that.
You know, there absolutely could be. It's very hard to see that in the data, but I'm willing to entertain it as an idea.
Well, we got an email from a caller in Stone Harbor who says, I'm right-handed but switched to my left hand for mouse work due to shoulder and back pain. After a few days, I became fluid in using the left and the pain is gone. How does this change affect the brain? And am I now alt-cis? There's a new term for you.
That's great. I mean, I will say that I think we know very little about the impact of switching people's handedness on their life outcomes. So my study was really about, you know, sort of what were you born as? Were you born a lefty or were you born a righty? I've actually seen some work recently coming out of a series of German data sets that try to ask the question, what does it do to kids to switch lefties when they're young to being righties? And there's actually some indication in that data that switching them, if anything, is bad, that it seems, you know, that our best guess is that if your kid is a lefty, if you're a lefty, you know, for the most part, leave yourself alone, just do what you're going to do, learn to write and with your left hand and you know, go on with your life.
And we don't know whether left-handedness is genetic?
Well, I think we do know that there is a genetic component to it. So there's no question that kids, for example, with left-handed mothers are substantially more likely to be left-handed themselves. And when you look at identical twins who share a genome are more likely to have the same handedness than fraternal twins do. And that indicates that there is some genetic component to it, although there is also an environmental component as well.
And there's also some research pointing to the amount of testosterone in the womb as a possible factor. Have you looked into that at all?
You know, I know of that research. I haven't looked into it myself. It certainly seems like it's pretty well grounded in the evidence. You know, I'll also say that there is fairly consistent evidence, both in my data and other data sets, that if as a baby in utero, if you're born with low birth weight or there are other complications during your birth process, you're actually a little bit more likely to be left-handed. So it seems that left-handedness is something that has a genetic component, but that there are things that can happen to you in utero that may affect the probability that you are left-handed in the long run.
As far as the possibility of learning difficulties is concerned, does this hold for lefties who were born healthy and who had the advantage of good care as children?
That's a great question. So it's really hard to ask that question in the data sets that we have. But the one thing that you can see is that lefties who are born to left-handed mothers actually do not seem to have disadvantages, at least when it comes to math and reading, relative to righties. So it all seems to be driven by the lefties who are born to right-handed mothers. Whether that means that this is a different kind of lefty, that if you're born to a right-handed mother and you're a lefty, it's because something went wrong in the womb, or just because maybe there's something about having a parent who understands what it is to be a lefty, and maybe that's helpful that you can, you know, you teach them writing or you teach them other skills. It's hard to say, but so there is some indication that it helps you as a lefty to have a left-handed mother.
And I'd like to get one more caller in before we wrap up. Gail in Northeast Philly. Hi, Gail. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Hi. You kind of have addressed somewhat the question I was going to bring up, which was what the research showed as far as children who were born left-handed but were forced to become right-handed. My former husband was a left-handed child whose parents were university professors, and he attended a university school in the 1960s. And the thinking then was that everyone should be right-handed to make it easier for them in the world. But yet I saw over many, many years great difficulties that he had, even writing right-handed. Every letter, every word he wrote had like a little tick between the letters, and he just couldn't translate. I think his brain didn't work in the same way as a right-handed person's, and he had many struggles I saw that related to the switching of his handedness.
Gail, thanks so much for the call to Radio Time. So, Joshua, are you following people, at least down the road, who actually were forced to switch handedness and how that might have affected them?
So that's a great question. The good news is in the data sets that we have in the U.S. and the U.K., being forced to switch is no longer very common. It was much more common 40, 50, 60 years ago, and it is more common in other countries on Earth. But as countries tend to get wealthier, they, for whatever reason, whether it's the superstition disappears or they just realize that putting kids through this process, this very painful process, can't possibly yield results that are worth it to the kid, people have tended to stop doing this. So I think switching is much less common. I don't see much of it actually in the data sets that I use because these are young, you know, relatively young people in the data sets.
Well, Joshua Goodman, we're up against the top of the hour, but I was going to ask about the advantages of being left-handed, but we might want to conclude by pointing out that a number of our recent presidents have been left-handed. Barack Obama, George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, all southpaws.
That's right. And my left-handed wife never forgets to remind me of that fact.
Joshua Goodman, it was so nice to have you with us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Joshua Goodman is Associate Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening to Radio Times.